Yes, here I am. My guest is Dr. Oren Pilkey, and here's what I want Dr. Pilkey to think about during the, you know, the break that we've got coming up, and that is, I'm willing to buy into what he's saying. That is to say that a lot of the modeling that's being done right now simply is inaccurate based on the sampling information. However, once you've said that, let's take climate change as an example. Once you've said that that the modeling is essentially trash, I'll be a little overly dramatic, I suppose, or perhaps not, but once you've said it's trash, then you have handed the enemies, the political enemies of whatever it is, whether it's global warming or whether it's AIDS, the AIDS epidemic and money for it, or the fisheries or beaches or any of these things, or even mines, any of these things that we're trying to come to conclusions on, you hand the enemies of these things ammunition which they're going to use improperly to just kill the whole thing. So I wonder if Dr. Pilkey worries about that. When you say the modeling is no good, then perhaps you're saying, well, global warming is simply not real because the models aren't real. We'll ask about that in a moment. Dr. Pilkey, I guess you heard what I had to say. I'm very curious. Do you worry about that?
Oh, do I ever. In fact, I'm terrified that you're absolutely right that this will be distorted. It can be distorted, and we can throw the baby out with the bath. But the truth must be known, and we must, you know, we're going up a dead end if we believe these models in their totality. We must recognize their limitations. And of course, I'm a strong believer in global warming and the fact that we people are responsible for at least part of it, a significant part of the warming. But when one criticizes something as fundamental as mathematical models in our society, there's a large group out there waiting right now, perhaps listening right now, that are waiting to jump on this and point out, you know, that all these things, you know, throw the baby out with the bath, that all this is wrong, all modeling is wrong, and that's not so. But you're right; it's a hazard of a book like this.
Mm-hmm. Do you cover that in the book?
I don't think we do. I'm trying to think. I don't think we say that. We hope we made a strong enough case, because we that can't happen. I mean, we say ad nauseum that there's a difference. There are good models and there are bad models. There are qualitative and there are quantitative models. And our modeling that we're talking about strictly has to do with major Earth surface processes like global warming,
for the benefit of the audience, explain the basic difference between the two models.
Yeah, good. In putting it in a quick way, quantitative models answer the questions where, when, and how much. How much is a project going to last? When is a beach going to disappear? Where is what's it going to be like in Las Vegas, Nevada, with the coming global warming? You know, this is quantitative. The qualitative models answer the questions how, why, and what if. Why is it getting warmer? What if we reduce our the amount of CO2 we're putting in the atmosphere? What might happen? How can we, so I think it's where, when, how much for quantitative, and how, what if, and why for qualitative. You have to think about that a little bit, but it's a pretty fair distinction. And in a quantitative model, you come up with an accurate answer. What you say is an accurate answer to a question about a process. How much sand is being transported on the beach? How much is the temperature going to increase? How many fish are left? And in a qualitative model, you say, will the temperature increase? Is it going to go up or is it going to go down? And and then for fishing, you'd say, well, is it, you know, you just answer the question quite differently. You ask the question and answer the question quite differently.
If I was an attorney, a doctor, and I had you on the stand, and I was on the side of trying to squash all of this global warming talk, I'd put you on the stand, and I wouldn't let you answer anything that I didn't want you to answer. I would just allow you to destroy the modeling being used by those promoting the concept that global warming is coming. And by the time I was done, I can assure you that you would destroy the whole concept of global warming without ever being able to say a word about your belief that it really is happening, despite the bad modeling.
Not if I was a good witness. Not if I was a good witness. A good witness knows how to make sure that the attorneys don't hold complete sway. You know, you've got to, when you answer the question, you've got to put in the plug for qualitative modeling and put in the fact that you believe that global warming is happening, and global warming is a real hazard for our society and for the world. You know, so you're right. On the stand, there's that tension between the outstanding attorney and often the scientist. This is not the scientist's field to be playing games, word games like the attorneys do, and oftentimes
and the politicians.
Yes, and oftentimes the scientists are crushed on the stand. They come off looking like idiots. You know.
Well, not necessarily so. I mean, I would take your book and I would say, look, doctor, I've read your book, and nowhere in there do you say that you believe global warming is real, but you do certainly, and this is a yes or no question, doctor, do you believe the modeling is accurate? Is that a yes or a no? And of course, you'd be forced to say no, it's not accurate.
Of course, I would try not to answer with a yes or no. that's pretty hard to do. You know, you're right. It's there is this hazard that does worry. That does worry us. That we don't want to throw the baby out with the bath, and this hazard exists. And I expect that I will be quoted, misquoted, and that our book will be misquoted in this regard.
I guarantee it. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
All right, Claudette in Mississippi, you're on the air with Dr. Pilkey. Hi.
Hi, Art. In 1995, I was in Egypt, and Zahi, you know, gets all upset about the salt on the walls in the Great Pyramid.
Yes.
Because it's tourist. History books say that the guy that first went in the pyramid found the salt on the walls. Okay, when the robot, I don't know if it was the Japanese, did the robot that went up the Queen's Chamber?
They did, yes.
All right, and then the French were allowed to drill into a massive area where they thought they might could find another cavern.
That's correct.
And sand started pouring out. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and then they stopped it up real quick because they thought it might be ballast. Okay, that sand was not indigenous to Egypt. It was radioactive, and it had gold flecks in it.
Okay.
Now that's something that Ahmed told us on the tour, and so I'm thinking maybe the ancients had a way of dealing with waste. Maybe they built pyramids to cover waste.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what the seraphim is. Maybe the bulls pulled all the waste and they built pyramids over it. And by the way, when I was there, I am a sculptor, and I did think that the stones were poured and sculpted on the pyramid.
All right. Do you have a question for Dr. Pilkey?
Well, it's just that could we do away with the radioactive waste by putting them in pyramids?
Okay.
That's an interesting question. The you know, there are natural sands, what we call heavy mineral sands, that could come from somewhere, not necessarily Egypt, that are radioactive. Slightly radioactive. There, for example, is a mineral called monazite, which is very abundant, which is somewhat abundant in some sands along the east coast of the U.S., and this is a radioactive mineral, and sometimes heavy minerals contain gold. So it might possibly be entirely a natural type sand. Could be.
Okay. All right. Let's go to Trent in Washington. You're on the air with Dr. Oren Pilkey.
I was wondering if you had heard of Patterson beads.
I think I have. I think these are the beads. These are the glass beads that I think we would. It's been proposed that we put our radioactive waste into glass beads in the form of glass beads, and the glass beads are inert, and therefore would prevent the radioactivity from escaping.
I don't believe that's quite it. These are little beads that were made with a gentleman that was working with Fleischmann and Pons when they did cold fusion, and that was in the news. And shortly after came out a TV rundown of that, and they showed a Geiger counter and a qualified amount of radioactive material.
Yeah, caller, I know what you're talking about. It was on Good Morning America, actually.
And that was I think, probably a year after the Fleischmann, after the cold.
It didn't have I don't think it had anything to do with cold fusion. It was a way of reducing the time that it took radioactive materials to decay, radically reducing the decay
right.
time.
And not taking on the radiation, but neutralizing it in a manner that they don't have any idea
that
how it
right.
does it. But it's a metal encapsulation of some kind, and it's got a series of I can't remember what they call it, but there was something in there that was like a little baffle plates or something that somehow neutralized it.
Mm-hmm.
And they demonstrated, they showed the Geiger counter, and as I recall, it was something like 200 years worth of deterioration or
that's right
neutralizing in a 20-minute period that they ran the Geiger counter for the show.
Okay, that is correct. There was a demonstration on Good Morning America. So there are a number of methods, Doctor, of reducing or speeding up radioactive decay. Now, this kind of thing where you see it on Good Morning America, and as he pointed out, they had a Geiger counter, and they seem to prove it, but then you never hear another word about it.
Well, you know, I stand corrected on Patterson beads, I guess. The beads that I was thinking of are the glass beads, which is one of the proposed approaches to storing radioactive waste, which sounds pretty good. We have a number of things that are being considered. But again, we move very slowly on that. But I'm unaware of any method that could reduce radioactive elements decay at a well-known rate. At least the most of them, all of them do. And that's how we configure the half-lives. And I'm unaware of any method that would increase the rate of radioactive decay. But
yeah,
I'll stand corrected if it's true.
Yeah, they did show it. It was on Good Morning America. It was very interesting, but then never another word about it. So
we'll
leave it
at
that, and maybe somebody will get us a follow-up. Mona in New Orleans, you're on the air with Dr. Pilkey.
Thank you. Hi, Art. Dr. Pilkey, I heard you mention that the Army Corps of Engineers won't be very happy with what you wrote in your book. I don't think that a lot of people know that they came out last June and admitted fault for the flooding that happened in New Orleans. And one thing I have found is that the Army Corps is very untouchable. There's a lot of bureaucracy involved.
Yeah, that is so true. You know, we have criticized their modeling in the technical literature. I've written several papers, me and my colleagues have written several papers on their individual mathematical model in the Journal of Coastal Research, and we've never gotten a response from them. We'd sure like to get a response, but they are untouchable for political reasons. That is, politicians like pork barrel projects, and they're the origin of pork barrel projects. But I mean, going back slightly here, the Corps, in a way, because the way the Corps is set up, where they have to have projects in order to survive, This makes them, I don't think any agency that has to have projects to survive could ever be honest and competent. We've set them up wrong. And that's the way the politicians want it. They want the Corps to do their bidding. So,
I think that people all over the country need to know there are those levees. Is it south of Sacramento?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were built the same design as the ones in New Orleans.
Yeah, I think there's a disaster waiting to happen in Sacramento too. There's been a lot of publicity about that recently because of the New Orleans problem, and there are other levees around the nation that are probably in danger from the so-called unexpected storm.
What about dams? Are they responsible for many of the dams all over the country?
Yeah, they are. They built some of the dams, not all of the dams, and by and large, our engineering of dams is pretty good, and there are a lot of small dams that are being considered hazardous and are being looked at carefully, but our major dams, by and large, are pretty well engineered. Of course, they create a lot of problems, but that's another matter.
Doctor, out of curiosity, she's from New Orleans. Was there any mathematical model that predicted exactly what would occur with that intensity of storm?
No, lot of models went into the design of the levees and the design of the storms, or the estimate of what the storms could do. I think, though, mathematical modeling did tell the Corps of Engineers that, for example, the levees would be breached where the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet Channel comes in. A modeler in LSU, and this would be just a qualitative model, said that there's going to be the storm surge right there where that channel intersects with the levees. The storm surge was going to be higher there because of the impact of the big channel, and it could potentially overtop the levees, and it did. Right, the Ninth Ward was immediately flooded by that overtopping of levees.
Is he the man that warned and warned and warned them?
There were a number of scientists and engineers who warned the Corps, and I think a lot of the politicians in Mississippi and Louisiana had to know that the levees were very vulnerable. They had been sinking, for example, and some of them were well below what they were when they were first built. I mean, that is an example of the problem with the Corps of Engineers. They should have fixed those levees, but they said. The Corps says, "Well, we tried to get the money. We asked, but they shouldn't just try. They should have been shouting from the mountaintops. And we don't accept failure from engineers who build bridges. Can you imagine building a bridge and say, well, it fell down because of an unusual storm, or the winds were too high and that water tower fell down? We don't accept that from other engineers, and we shouldn't have accepted it." Here and the fault goes to a lot of people for New Orleans, but the Corps of Engineers is a big one.
We've got to hold it right there. When I come back, I'd like to ask you if the levees in New Orleans are now fixed, so that when the next storm of that kind of magnitude comes along, all will be well. From the High Desert, I'm Art Bell. Dr. Oren Pilkey is my guest, and his book is Useless Arithmetic, Why Environmental Scientists Can't Predict the Future. And that title alone provoked the question that I asked just prior to the top of the hour. It's very worrisome to me that, just based on the title alone, you go, boy, here's some ammunition for the anti-global warming people and a lot of the rest of them as well. And it certainly is that. So that said, Dr. Pilkey firmly seems to be on the side of those who believe global warming is going on. He just doesn't like the methods used in some of the modeling. So I want you all to be straight on that. I'm Art Bell. In a moment, we continue. And Dr. Pilkey, welcome back. I want to ask you a very sensitive question, and that is, are the levees in New Orleans now repaired to the degree that if they get a storm of similar intensity, and it's certainly likely, that all will hold up and be well?
Well, I think it's widely recognized, even by New Orleans people, that they will not, that there is still a high risk of these levees failing in one fashion or another, either being overtopped where that channel comes in, or perhaps failing along some of the other sections that weren't repaired. I hope nobody really is convinced that they're perfectly safe now. I mean, it's a very serious problem, and we have to have a societal debate as to whether we should rebuild those levees in a time of rising sea level and in a time of decreasing salt marshes out in front of New Orleans, which is going to increase the storm surge, the height of the storm surge. Should we do this? Should we move the city? At least we need to have this debate, and we're not having that, unfortunately.
Clearly not. All right, let's go to Jim in Los Angeles. You're on with Dr. Pilkey. Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering, you were saying that in Hawaii they had that the only place there was that was checking out the carbon dioxide levels. And doesn't a lot of that come up from the Southeast Asia and Australia and whatnot? Because remember I'll probably remember the sands coming up there and blowing up from China, and we get smoke and stuff that they track back to China, fires in China and Australia and whatnot.
As a matter of fact, that's true.
Oh, certainly, absolutely. The CO2 that's being measured on Mauna Loa is believed to be a good measure of global CO2 concentrations, and it's coming from everything. It's coming from volcanoes. It's coming from industry everywhere. Yes, there's no question. It's coming from a lot of places. It's certainly not a measure just of CO2 from North America or from Hawaii. It's considered to be a good global measure.
Now, actually, Doctor, he's referring to a sandstorm in Mongolia. Now, there was a time a few years ago that our skies here in southern Nevada turned yellow. And they were yellow for several days while the weather guys on TV here in Las Vegas scratched their heads about yellow. What's the yellow all about? Well, it turned out to be a sandstorm in Mongolia.
Hey, that's very interesting. We have the same problem on the East Coast. We have sandstorms from the Sahara that have affected climate in the weather in South Florida and in the Caribbean. And so, yeah, this is a global world, so to speak. Things from a long ways away can have a lot of impact on us. It was mysterious where the early natives of the Bahamas were getting clay to form pottery. And it turns out that they were getting clay that came from African dust and accumulated in crevices in the limestone. So there's a lot of that going on.
It is a small world. All right, yeah. Robin in Oklahoma, you're on with Dr. Pilkey.
Hi, Art. Hey,
hi.
Hope your cats are getting better.
They are.
Oh, good. I have a question. Do they ever do modeling for environment on, like, our food chain? I know the smoking's bad, but they never seem to touch the food. We have chicken factories down here, they put the litter out. Well, when they're growing them, they give them arsenic. Besides that, they pump them full of antibiotics. They give them arsenic and all kinds of stuff. I mean, they're going faster and faster from egg to gold market. And they put the chicken litter out. Okay, maybe it is in our streams, it is in our drinking water, our lake, where we get our water. They tested our lake, the lake where we get our water, 10 or so years ago. There's arsenic in it and all kinds of stuff. I just wonder if they ever make models, on how everything affects everybody else.
They certainly are doing that kind of modeling. Some of that modeling is very good, than the qualitative modeling of what goes on in streams and lakes. And of course, this becomes very political. And because of politics, sometimes we we don't use those models or don't use the results of those models the way we should. That's a very common accusation of the current administration. Looking at how these pollutants that you speak of move in groundwater becomes a more difficult modeling problem. Modeling groundwater flow is difficult, very difficult.
Okay. On to Matt in Salt Lake City. You're on with Dr. Pilkey. Hi.
Hi. God, I love number crunching. I'm glad to hear you got this guest. carbon dioxide. I got a bunch of questions. For instance, when they take the numbers for carbon dioxide, I saw in the paper recently that we reached over 7 million tons in the United States. But here I want to read in the encyclopedia here, the natural output of carbon dioxide is around 700 million tons. So our country puts out about 1/100th of the natural process. But I was going to ask you, are you aware or not if they include the northern lights into that figure? You know, because there's like somewhere between, I think it was 10 to 50 million tons coming in as methane ammonia off the sun and northern lights. All by itself. Does that include in the study also?
Actually, the measures, you're absolutely right that natural CO2 is huge. The production of natural CO2 is huge. And we're talking about, when we talk about production of CO2, we're talking about production of excess CO2. CO2 that is produced or is in the atmosphere at a concentration that's too high for the oceans to absorb it, or for the forests or whatever to absorb the CO2. And so that's why, no, absolutely, the human contribution may be quite small compared to natural production of carbon dioxide. And I'm not aware of the role of northern lights in the product. You said methane, I think, another greenhouse gas. I'm not aware of the role of northern lights in that. I'm sorry.
Speaking of methane, methane coming off the sun is one source of methane. I know that some people say methane takes a long time to break down the atmosphere, and when I looked up in the chemistry book, it says it breaks down in sunlight rather quickly. That's why it's undetectable unless you're near a methane source. But what I was going to ask you is that, you know, they talk about cows being methane producers and we should do it with cows, but I'm thinking, well, if the grass lays on the ground and rots, or if the cow eats it and digests it quickly and makes methane out of it, isn't it the net sum zero? I mean, there's no gain either way?
No, I don't think that. I mean, the cow, manufactures methane. It wasn't there before. They manufacture it chemically in their bodies. And, yes, they, interestingly enough, are a major source of methane, which is a surprise to me. This is not my field of endeavor. But one of the new methane sources that's just becoming apparent is the melting of ice, the permafrost, in the tundra of the Arctic, in Siberia mm-hmm. especially.
Right.
Russian scientists are finding that a huge amount of methane is being released in this melt, and CO2 as well, by the way. But this melting is going on at a pretty fast rate. The permafrost is moving up. The limit, the line of permafrost, no permafrost, is moving north at a very rapid rate. And as it moves north, it releases more and more CO2 and methane.
Doctor, there is a great debate going on right now, and I think it has something to do with modeling. And this debate circles around what are called these triggers, these points where what's happening is going to accelerate a gigantic rate. There's going to reach some point in this environmental process where, kind of like flipping a switch, it's going to really accelerate past what we can even imagine.
That's true. There is a debate about that. You know, and I think you're aware of the 8,200 years ago, we had what looked like a climate surprise where suddenly a huge cooling occurred and just lasted for, at least in the eyes of some scientists, it lasts for 20 or 30 years. This is based on field evidence. And yes, there are other surprises. For example, the Gulf Stream, that could happen on a decadal time frame. So, yeah, there are potential surprises that, and surprise means it's not predictable, although although we can use qualitative models to say this is what could happen, and that's where it's very, where the models are very important. But predicting when it's going to happen is not possible.
Okay. Sam in Michigan, you're on with Dr. Pilkey. Good morning.
Morning, Ed. Let's see. In 05, the hurricane season, James McCanney made some startling observations in that the quantitative energy of that hurricane season relative to 06 was a fraction, and yet 06 had almost no hurricanes. That's one observation I'd like him to comment on. The other is...
They totally missed 06. I mean, all the modeling said it was going to be, I forget how many they predicted, but they just totally missed it.
Yeah, and then David Sarita program last year revealed the fact that he had been commissioned by the energy industry to investigate the most feasible alternative energy source. He discovered helium-3 and a fusion process that he said was easily attainable.
I recall, yes.
And yet, it's just all... And then the European Space Agency, this ought to get a rise out of everybody. In 2001, Art, I saw this in a documentary video. They launched their deep space probes not with nuclear power, but with highly advanced solar equipment on board these space vehicles.
Okay, well, I'm not as sure about that, but Doctor, they did really miss 06 in terms of the U.S. East Coast. All the modeling apparently told them it was going to be a horrible year for hurricanes. Well, almost nothing touched us. On the other hand, over on the Pacific side, the typhoons were unbelievable. So where was the modeling for all of that?
Well, I think that's a really good example of where we stand in our modeling, in accurate modeling of this is a major process, the hurricane, something we really need to know about. And we're not at a stage where we can predict this, and we haven't been very good in the past either. So I think, and we've learned to live with that. I think we can just kind of view the prediction about hurricanes for the next year being something like stock market predictions, and kind of curious and maybe interesting, but we shouldn't take them much more seriously than that.
Oh, boy. Bruce in Memphis, you're on with Dr. Pilkey. Good morning.
Hey, Art. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And hi, Dr. Pilkey. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I was in New Orleans for the storm and for 6 days, so I got to watch the water rise and everything. There's a man named Douglas Brinkley that could be considered a historical modeler. He wrote Rising Tide, 1927 Flood, but he also has a book
called
Deluge that's about the storm, and it's more of a historical modeling. My question for you is, I'm nervous because I'm on the phone. They had predicted with a fictitional Hurricane Pam almost a year to the day before Hurricane Katrina. And that mm-hmm. came out of LSU, and that was a climatologist or climate scientist at LSU. And he's I think, German. I'm not sure. His name escapes me. Douglas Brinkley does not. Everyone should read Deluge. But I was wondering if you knew about that study. And in the Hurricane Pam scenario, they calculated a hurricane Category 3. And it flooded almost exactly where they said it would flood. And I was wondering if you knew about
that. That was the man. That was the man that warned and warned and warned and warned. I think, in fact, I think he was on 60 Minutes, wasn't he?
He was. He went to Congress.
Yeah, yeah. He's the guy.
They paid him to do that. They paid a lot of money for that, the federal government, for that study. And apparently just put it in their drawer, in their desk, and let it go. I'm not sure. But it flooded at the 7, you know, they predicted it. And I was wondering if you knew about the Corps of Engineers mathematical modeling for the Mississippi Delta floodplain, and if you knew about any of that, as the water rises, as the climate rises and the waters rise, where does Memphis sit in that? I mean, is Memphis going to be coastal property?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. River modeling is actually, I believe the Corps' modeling of the behavior of the Mississippi River may have been better back when they used a physical model, you know, an actual model on the ground. But that's another matter. But I think the example you're using of modeled predictions of what could happen with a Category 3 hurricane by the individual in LSU, I'm sure is true, and that's a good example of a qualitative model. You know, you just assume a certain level, and it has to be reasonable as far as atmospheric processes are concerned, and then you look at the elevation of the levees, and that's good modeling. He didn't say, I'm sure, when it was going to occur. He said, if it occurs, this is what's going to happen. And of course, we knew it would occur someday, and we know that it will occur again someday. So, you know, we gotta. What does it take us? What does it take for us to learn?
Kathy in Ontario, up in Canada, you're on the air with Dr. Pilkey. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Dr. Pilkey.
Hi.
I recently read your book, Art, that you wrote with Whitley Strieber.
Oh, yes.
And I thought it was pretty well put together.
Thank you.
And, yeah, it's quite a concern. And like that fellow that phoned that said we just got winter in Canada here a couple weeks ago, it seems kind of pretty odd. But I've been noticing global warming myself for the last 9, 10, 15 years maybe. And I have a maybe stupid question, but even though it might be stupid, I still would want to know why. And that is, I know that the nuclear waste needs to be contained, but is there any way that you can, like, cook it, like, heat it in a volcano or something?
In a volcano.
To neutralize it?
Well, Dr. there are other people who would like to launch it into the sun.
Yes, that's true. And there was some talk about burying it in the deep sea in trenches. The problem there being that eventually that would be that the way trenches work, eventually maybe 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years, it might be coming back as volcanoes and you know, launched into the air. So into the
atmosphere. Just what we'd need. Listen, Dr. Pilkey, it has been a pleasure. I hope your book is not taken and used as inappropriate material to knock a lot of things that are going on down. I hope it's used in the right way.
Thank you for saying that. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, Art.
All right, my friend. Thank you, and you have a good night. The clock says we've got to go. We've got to go. Good night, Dr.
Good Pilkey. Night.
And for everybody else, and I guess Crystal's got blue back, so is the time of day it is. Good night, all. See you next weekend. I'm Art Bell. Ciao.